Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being punctual, and I think we should reward your punctuality by starting on time to give our important speaker the maximum use of our allocated 50 minutes. In this session, Kent is aiming to provoke your thinking. He's hoping perhaps have some of you squirming in your seats, but above all, he wants to challenge you to think differently about the future of life insurance. So I'm keen to listen to Kent. I'm also very keen to listen to your responses when we come to the discussion time. So for disclaimer of my interest, as a director of both a direct insurer and a reinsurer, I'm actively involved in the sector and especially squirming with some of Kent's positions. So a warning, there is no formal paper for this session. However, Kent's quality presentation will be made available after the summit. And it's not just me that's going to be interested in your responses. Kent is also looking forward to the discussion time, so we'll leave about 15 minutes at the end for your questions, comments, objections, etc. So this afternoon we have a provocative title with a provocative presenter. Kent Hopper is the... Provocative presenter is a term of endearment, Francis. Kent Hopper is the principal at Zoella Consulting, where he provides actuarial and well-being advisory services. His prior roles include executive vice president at Leap for Life, a well-being engagement platform which was involved in codifying the lifestyle genome. Prior to that, he was the chief innovation, the chief innovation officer at CommInsure, where, among other things, he developed and executed the first longevity swap transaction in Australia. Kent is a founding member of the Australian Society for Progress and Wellbeing, and, as you have probably gathered from that introduction, is here today because of his passion for understanding the business implications of the major changes we're facing in society. Please welcome Kent Hopper.
Thank you, Martin. What an introduction. Really appreciate it very much. So every week in our roles, we are coming up against the challenges that our industry faces. And to me, when I look at the big picture, when I look at the totality of all those challenges, I have to say I think our response has been pretty inadequate, fragmented, and lacking a distinct sense of urgency around many of these things. Now, in part, I think this is because these things often unfold slowly. And it's not until they're right on top of us and we're forced to take action, as we are seeing very much at the moment. But we here are the so-called future managers. And I think this reactive approach is something that we should all be pretty unsatisfied with. So what I want to do today is try and stimulate some forward thinking and debate amongst the profession. I don't mind if you strongly disagree with me, that's okay, but it's getting that forward-looking view. So let's start off with where we're at. How bad is it? And, it's session after lunch, so I think we need to be a little bit light to keep everyone awake. So let's call this one the elephant in the room. Australia's obesity epidemic. And it's moving by around about 10 percentage points, the prevalence, every 15 years. Really, very scary stuff. Big numbers on the national burden. You'll see various numbers quoted depending on which source you go to, but it's a big number. In the insurance sense, we tend to start looking at obesity as a risk factor from class 2. That's BMI greater than 35. BMI greater than 40 is class 3. So this is severe obesity. And the shocking thing is that those two classes are growing at double and triple the rate of class 1. So this is having a direct impact on our business. I tried to think of a way to bring this back into more concrete terms for us. So I imagined if we were to just go and rewrite the whole book today of our retail book, round numbers, call it $6 billion, prevalence of class 2 and 3, maybe in that order of 10%, 9 to 10%, and typically it would be something like a plus 50% loading. Well, you're talking about $300 million. So it's indicative, it's rough, but it's just helping to give us a sense of where this is going. So what's the big deal? The slide doesn't work. There it is. So these stats should all be, if not familiar to you, fairly intuitive. It's a primary risk factor in all those major claim causes that we love and know and deal with every single day. The one that you may not be that familiar with and that's missing from that list is cancer. And the Cancer Council of Australia had this to say: our elevated obesity rates are a cancer time bomb. Strong words indeed. And the second thing is that the delay between the onset of obesity and that of a claim masks the urgency around all of this. So the claims impact is actually yet to be seen. It's too late to do something once the chronic disease has happened. This is a seminal trend that is impacting our experience as it goes through time. And the issue is we don't do anything as insurers to manage risk through time. We write the policies, put them on our books, and then we really hope that things are going to pan out. And lastly, there are the implications for our future offers. If 40% of the population is obese in about 10 years' time, as the projections say, what's that going to mean for the insurance offer that we can provide? So I think, in many ways, we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg to what obesity is going to mean for the life insurance industry. And as if that wasn't enough, it's actually a lot worse than this. There's a study by the guys at Baker IDI here in Melbourne that looked at the prevalence of obesity not only by BMI but by waist circumference. Now, there's very practical reasons why you use BMI. It's much easier to measure, and there's all sorts of problems with that, with waist circumference. But we also know that waist circumference is a much more powerful predictor of risk. So this is about over 4,000 lives, and like the ABS data, measuring it by BMI, we got around the 27% mark as the obesity prevalence. But by waist circumference, 48%. And by severely obese, the class 2s and 3s type thing, more than double what the ABS data is saying. Really, really scary stuff. Only 22% in 2012 were a healthy weight. At the baseline in 2000, that was a third. So that has absolutely plummeted. So if we to rework my very crude, rough, indicative cost number with a 21% type number, now we're talking about something like an $800 million problem. So it's really significant stuff. Now, the things that help appointed actuaries and pricing actuaries sleep all right at night is typically this common term that we have. We can reprice our business or classes of policies. And that's okay, provided your pricing cells don't disintegrate, provided that there is not too much disparity of the risks within those pricing cells. And my concern with all of this is that we're seeing such massive shifts in population health that there's got to be a threat to that assumption. So I think we need to take a much more proactive response to the program than just thinking it's going to be okay and we'll have that pressure valve to rely on. Let's turn to tech. Who's got a... hands up. Who's got a device? Who's got more than one device? Cycling? Yes. Swimming? Who uses an app? On the phones? Yeah. This is a huge, huge trend. Not as many as I would have thought, to be honest, actually. We're a very unfit bunch in this room. But this is a huge trend, and Business Insider projected it around about 300 million units per annum in the next few years. Anyone got the watches, the Galaxy or the Samsung or the Apple Watch? No, not yet? Okay, we're not up early adopters either. And this is all part of the Internet of Things. So there's billions of sensors connected to the Internet, projected by Gartner there. It's the smart home, the automation, all that kind of stuff is a big chunk of it. But these sensors around the health and wellness space are projected to be huge winners of all of this. So we're talking about things like disposable patches that are tracking your vitals, under-skin continuous glucose monitoring, sensors in your clothes. This all sounds very sci-fi stuff, but it's actually real today. And it evolves also into the home. So people now, and it's this device on the bottom right-hand corner here, device is probably the wrong word, is enabling people to do their own screening at home for bowel cancer. That's a threat with that one. we've always faced this idea of information asymmetry, that the prospective policyholder knows more than us, but this has obviously just been upped and upped and upped as technology enables. There's also a wonderful, wonderful opportunity. We can transform the insurance proposition with this, driving better health outcomes, positive self-selection opportunities, and more. Okay, let's come a bit closer to home. There's a fantastic session in the last session that Danny Shuttleworth and Jenny Gibson did. I encourage you to go and have a look at their slides. It covers a lot of what I'm going to cover in this one and more. So the standout reason, standout business for all the wrong reasons would have to be group insurance, as we all very much know. And it's billions lost. It's to the right of that blue curve. It's that whole triangle, not just the 2013 number. 2014 isn't a whole lot better. It's similar to 2012 numbers there. Now, we're also seeing income protection continues to hit the headlines. And this is something that we were talking about maybe about 15 years ago. I remember seeing big increases in rates, reinsurance capacity reducing. And that's exactly what we're seeing, have been seeing, of course, in group insurance. Now, yes, there are external factors involved in all of this, but a large chunk of this has to be classified as self-inflicted and us to blame. We need to own this, and we need to get in front of it and fix it. And the question that keeps on coming to my mind around this when I see history repeating is, where is the corporate memory? Why is this continually happening? And what are we going to do that means that in 15 years' time, or 10 years' time, whatever it is, we're not standing here having the same kind of conversation, but this time around trauma and probably IP again? And there's the proverbial steak knives associated with all of this too. All that stuff that, you know, you guys are probably very, very much aware of. The one I'd probably call out is the overbearing risk compliance mindset. Don't get me wrong, I'm very, very passionate and a big believer in risk management. What I do sense, though, in some places, is that you look at the sizes of the teams, you look at the paper trail you've got to go through. Is it really adding value? Is it really what we're trying to achieve here? It often seems to me that it's just to retard progress, make things go slow for the sake of it. That's how risk management tools slow everything down. That's not the way the world's working. And the last one, the transformation projects. I'm aware of at least three companies that are spending millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars on these transformation projects. Are they spending it on the right stuff? And secondly, of course, it's an acknowledgement that we are not necessarily doing things the way we should be. Okay, let's go a bit external now. Turn our attention outwards. Here's a quote from Aaron Levy, who's the founder of Box, the competitor of Dropbox. Everything changes when we move from an industrial economy to an information economy. So what does that mean? Well, it means going from slow to agile, risk-oriented versus consumer-oriented, headquarter-based, process-centric to mobile distributed, expensive versus cheap, closed versus open, analog one-size-all, fit-size-fits-all, digital, smart, predictive. The world is changing, and we're not keeping pace. And the bad news is, for us in the life insurance industry, is we're on the wrong side of that balance sheet. And I don't want to go the way of the dinosaurs, so we've got to change. Not only is it changing, but it's strange. You don't know who your competitors are going to be now. Google making driverless cars, alternative currencies, Amazon with a fleet of drones, they've got cleared airspace now for that. And the other part, of course, is the big data and predictive analytics. We're seeing things that we've never seen before. So Amazon can actually ship things now before you've even ordered them. Well, they've got the patent to do that. They haven't implemented yet. They don't know which house, but I'll fill out the address en route. And their goal is to get things to you, not even necessarily within hours, but within minutes. That's where it's heading. Think of our industry. We're sleepy old dinosaurs. We've got to pick it up. The Target story is a well-known one. Many of you probably have heard it, where some parents gave a very strongly worded phone call to Target about mailing their daughter about pregnancy, you know, nappies and all that sort of stuff that they were suggesting she might like to purchase, only have to retract everything because Target had actually picked it out right that their daughter was pregnant, she just hadn't got round to telling Mum and Dad yet. So it's everything, and it goes on and on and on. So where does all this point? Well, it's disruption. It's disruption, disruption everywhere. And the way that we're going to be competitive is by trying to work out how do we disrupt our own business? How are we going to learn more quickly? And that's actually quite liberating if you're not so firmly wedded to your own business. It can be also quite threatening for your competitors if you can pull it off. The relentless need for speed, I think that's something that you're seeing all the time, and that's only going to compress more and more and more. And the interest of time, the last one is an overarching theme, this concept of relevancy, right time, right person, right topic and place. It's extreme personalisation. And an example I love about this is Pandora. Anyone here use Pandora? You guys are so in the past. Unbelievable. Okay, so Pandora, just as well I put this bit in, this is how it works. Thank you. Thank you. I've got one person. So you register, you put in a favourite song, piece of music or artist, whatever, and then that's the seed, and then they start just filling your queue with stuff that they think you might like, and it's just a continuous feedback loop, thumb up, thumb down. So what you end up with is this personalised, hyper-personalised radio station just for you. It's very, very cool. And they've taken it up another level where if you thumb up a song, some fans are instantly connected by video chat with a one-on-one with the artist that they've just thumbed up. Very, very cool. That's the consumer experience that's out there these days. That's where things are going. And I wonder, how are we going to compete with that if that's where consumer sentiment and expectations are? It bears thinking about. And the thing I love about Pandora is that the CEO says, actually, we're not a music streaming service. We're a data company. They have 450 attributes that they've identified to tag every piece of music with. And the thing about that is music, very compelling, very emotive, and it enables them to create a fingerprint of preferences and behaviours. So they can do things like this. They can predict, this is a while ago, it might be better, they can predict to 90% confidence who people will vote for in an election, just from your music preferences. Now, their business model, the way they monetise this, is normal advertising kinds of means. But that data is going to go places. And I wonder what it could mean for us. So, in summary, with a tip of the hat to Deloitte for the phrase, life insurers are a textbook case, in my view, for this short view's big bang disruption. Short views is not too far away. And big bang, it's going to be significant. Facebook have more lifestyle data on the planet than anybody else. They could get a just-in-time insurance product out in a matter of months. They just know how to turn their mind to it. So, wellness. How are we going to bridge all these different contradictions? Well, I believe that wellness has a wonderful opportunity for us. But rightly so, there's a lot of cynicism and suspicion about it, well-founded. So the question is wellness too good to be true? So to help us, we need to bring in some experts, Adam and Jamie, and help you guys stay awake after lunch. So myth number one, people will act in their own best interest. So this is the traditional wellness formula. If I tell you what you should do, if I make you aware of the conditions in your life and the things that are happening in your life, then you'll take it from there and do the right thing. It's field of dreams. If I build it, you'll go and do it. The smiles already tell me what you think of that one, but that's the way the world's been operating. Millions and millions of dollars get spent on this approach. Your corporate wellness plans that many of you would have, they're based on that kind of model. And guess what? They don't work. And the RAND report was a big report done in the US that proved that out. The issue is not telling people what they should do. They pretty much know it. It's making it a compelling choice for them day in, day out. So much effort, so little gained, and the boys would say, busted, well and truly. Myth number two, wearables will save the day. 300 million units per annum in a couple of years' time, surely that's the answer. Well, Endeavour and partners have plotted usage over a few years around these things, and a third give up after 6 months, more than half give up completely within 2 years. Why? because they're lacking these engagement principles. It's one-dimensional. Most people, even if they do look at the data, and many don't, they just never look at it again. It has no real relevance or purpose to my life. Now, there is some evidence, by the way, this is a little old, there is some evidence that curve is flattening out with the smartwatches and things, and it's becoming a little bit more of a status sort of a thing to have one of these devices on your wrists. But whether that's going to actually translate in changes in behaviour, conscious changes in behaviour or not, that's still to be seen. So, yep, that one too, Adam and Jamie say, busted. Wellness actually isn't about wellness. What do you reckon? Busted, plausible, confirmed, no one's willing to gain. Have a go, right? Well, traditional wellness doesn't work because it fails to keep attention. It's very fragmented, very episodic. The single most thing you are trying to save is to solve is getting attention and keeping it. That's what you want to do. That's solving the engagement gap. So, get attention. That one is definitely confirmed. Wellness is not about wellness, it's about getting and keeping attention. Targeting the at-risk is the optimal approach. This is something that most insurers would go for. Let's find the most at-risk and hit them hard. Seems like a very rational economic approach. But that's actually not how wellbeing works. It's got a social context to it. So this is a narrow approach. It alienates the other 99% of your population. It's very disease management focused. Well, that message has... Australians have tuned off to that message. They hear that all the time. And it's really a bit of a casino play. You can't mandate good behaviours. That's why that one fails. So the alternative is what I call the social economics approach. It's broad. It's relevant to all your customers. It's leveraging those social engagement principles. It's multidimensional, lifestyle optimization, and it's de-risk. You're focusing on a multi-dividend policy or approach. That one works because good behaviours can be inspired and cultivated through motivational principles. So wellness is a business strategy. So here's our typical type of value chain. And the place that most insurers would start, as per the last slide, would be here, at the claims end. The problem is, and that's because we've got all that kind of data and research in our minds that we use day to day, but the problem is that this ends up leading to narrow and ineffective product tweaks. And it's often the things like the traditional wellness types of things we're talking about, email newsletters and flu shots and things. But the value chain is drawn that way for a reason. Which of the chevrons affect claims? Pardon? Exactly. All of them. It's a bit late to get involved just at the end. So wellness is not a product feature, which is the way it's often viewed and where it fails. Wellness is a business strategy, and you've got to think about it on all parts of the value chain. So what could that maybe look like? This is not working very fast, but there's a whole range of things that you could be focusing on in the way that you construct your wellness program. The one I really like is this transform the customer value proposition. So no longer is insurance now the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. It's not even necessarily just the fence at the top of the cliff. But let's make it, thinking about that Pandora experience, let's make it the playground and picnic area that I want to come to every day. Insurance by itself, no way it's going to do that. But if I can create a wellness proposition that's relevant and meaningful and has value to my everyday life, fantastic. I'm interested. Social rewards me. And as a certain president would say, it's the data stupid. Sorry, Bill. But it's all of this is underpinned by the data. It's riding that wave. So that one's confirmed. So what would work? It's what doesn't, what would work. When I was at Leap for Life, the formula, after thinking all about this, the thing that we came up with was this one. Easy to start, plus fun, plus social, power it up with rewards, and that's what's going to drive motivation. Thinking about engagement, motivation is the thing we're trying to solve. It's got to be based on the social is the glue, really, very much in that way. Maybe that formula could be redrawn to better way to highlight that, but health is socially influenced. Now, there are lots of companies out there that do one or two or three of these. No one that I'm aware of and that lots of venture capital companies have told me does all of this. No one's out there doing it this way. So Leap for Life is a platform product. It's open, it's agnostic, and it's a virtual aggregator of all our healthy lifestyle active behaviours. And what we're trying to do with this is drive towards organic engagement. Now, organic engagement is really just a set of attributes that are so compelling that it drives the population to the point of adoption, that tipping point. So the kinds of things that we're talking about there are all these guys: personal relevance, gamification, recognition, and so on. Making it part of my everyday life. Gamification is huge. There's people Candy Crush and Farmville and all those things. They love to play games. So if you can wrap the health equation in that, that's a winner. But how do we do that in at Leap for Life? So we're collecting all these different data sources. It could be your activity stuff, it could be your preferences, it could be social data, it could be transactional data, medical data, whatever it is, this huge funnel of data. And to give it more context and relevance and meaning, what we're doing is we're wrapping that into a game. So an event is just something where there is a behavioural outcome that you want. It could be go for a 10K run, get a flu shot, pay your insurance premium, whatever it is. Some kind of behavioural outcome you're looking for. You set criteria to that, and then if I participate and I meet that criteria, I get my points, I get my reward. Otherwise, I miss out. Tough luck. So it links in then with that rewards point, bullet point further below. I'm getting these points then, I'm converting my everyday activities into cash. I can go and take my points and buy my iPad or whatever it is. So that's the thing that overcomes the behavioural economics aspect of delayed discounting of I know the right thing to do is to go for a run, but the cost of doing that is more than what I place on the value of a better, healthy life in the future. We've got to change that equation, tip it more into the favour of making the right choices today and every day. I think in the interest of time, how are we going?
I think about 3 minutes, if you like.
No, let's have more discussion. I'm more interested in actually hearing from these guys.
Okay, thanks, Kent. Hopefully that is suitably provocative and gives you some base for comments, questions. So as you're all be aware, this is being recorded for the 99% of the membership who aren't here. So if you could please use the microphone in the middle and mention your name. Now, we also have a full room, and I know it might take a little while for some people to get to the microphone. So for today, cues are allowed. So if you would like to make a comment, like to challenge Kent, or you want some more information, or you've got a question, by all means, just line up so we don't have the waiting time for the next speakers. So as we speak, the microphone is available for anybody that who would like to make a contribution. And as we said at the beginning, Kent is keen to hear a response, and he's also welcome challenges. If you think he's overstated some of the challenges, let's put him in his place. If there are some things that you've got some additional insights, it's a great time to add them. All right? So, microphone's there. I went to the previous session with
Barry Ray talking about the impact of obesity. Oh, that's not very encouraging.
I went to the who went to the obesity section with Barry. So I think he was challenging the amount of reliance on obesity as a rating factor until you got relatively extreme. Although I think he did acknowledge, though, that it is a significant issue when it comes
to health costs, which presumably batteries are.
Which presumably is going to impact morbidity and those things. So your view on, from what you've read, just to follow up for people who went to Barry's session, your view on the impact on mortality versus morbidity?
Yeah, I mean, all these lifestyle things, they affect health first. So you can see the health insurers every time you look at a annual report of a health insurer, you see their claims costs going up, and they'll always remark about lifestyle-related conditions, then morbidity, then mortality. I didn't attend Barry's session this morning. I did read his paper, though. I think he rightly calls out that it's not simple, that there is more dimensions to it. Perhaps physical exercise may be a better predictor for us to use. That's something that I think still needs to be researched and examined more. But certainly the means to do that now is well and truly here, and it's coming at the rate of 300 million knots every year. So, yeah, I think that's an area where more work is needed.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Yep, as I said, cues are perfectly acceptable, in fact encouraged, to save time. So we have our first question from the floor.
Eddie Fraser. Can't we see a lot of things happening about peer-to-peer lending? Do you think they'll come with all this data which is going out there, and probably with the government's metadata retention, if we can ever link all these data sources together, that peer-to-peer insurance may happen where, you know, a group of individuals get together and they get some data together and they find that, you know, Kent's really interested in wellbeing programs and therefore must be a good risk and make you the offers you can't refuse. Do we see any evidence anywhere in the world of things like that starting to happen? I mean, everyone talks about, you know, I know you made a comment about Facebook having all this data and Google having all that, but at the moment I'm not seeing anywhere in the world a lot of evidence of people trying to pick out subsections from various data sources and do individual marketing, you know, the customer of one type concept.
Yeah, love it. Let's go into business together. Fantastic idea. Fantastic idea. And look, and that's the thing, is that kind of completely turning on its head thinking is where we're at. I mean, that's Silicon Valley, that's what they do, and regulated markets are being attacked by these guys. Who would have thought about Bitcoins? So you know, it might seem like a pipe dream, it might seem no way, no, not possible. But if you're getting a premium of 5, 10, 15% on a really small micro sum assured, and that person's just aggregating it from a whole stack of people, why not? I can easily see someone thinking maybe this is the next foray to go for. So we'll wait and see. But no, I haven't seen any evidence of that yet.
Hi, Kent. The industry's been talking and discussing...
Sorry.
The industry's been talking and discussing about wellness programs now for, it's Francis Burgess here, for about 7 or 8 years, I think, at least we've been having that conversation. The pace of development in the market is probably only one large insurer and perhaps not that many people following through. What are the main barriers you see as why insurers haven't sort of gone, why not everybody in the market is operating in these wellness schemes? What stopped it taking the whole market by storm? Because it's certainly been around for quite a while.
You're not going to like the answer. We are really conservative in this country, very, very conservative about this. And it's not for lack of trying, let me tell you. You know, I did a lot of travel to the States back and forth in particular on this, and there is a lot more open receptivity to these things. And not surprisingly, they've got their huge medical costs that they have in the companies and so forth. They don't have socialised medicine like us. But we are just very, very reluctant to jump on and try something. I saw Ian Narev, was it at a bank summit or something a few weeks ago, saying, yeah, you know, we need to turn this around. As long as we're not betting the house, we should be trying new things. So there's some hope that there's a change at the top echelons of how we deal with this. But really, it's coming down to having a go, and we're not yet willing to do that. And you can't, sorry to jump in, and the other thing is with wellness, you can't just sort of dip your toe in and expect to change the water. This is making an investment, and it's this business strategy idea. We confine it to this product feature thing, minimise the cost. No, that's not going to work. You've really got to jump in and go for it.
Dennis Wilkinson, Kent, thanks very much for that presentation, particularly the first half around life insurance, which I thought was particularly useful in terms of the way in which the market is changing. One other thing you didn't mention, but I'm sure it's one that you've considered, because I think it flows on from what you're talking about, was the impact of genetics and genetic testing and where that fits into the old structure of underwriting that sits within life insurance. It seems to me at the moment that although the industry has taken a position around genetic information and, in fact, not using genetic information, if I can go to the US and for $50 can get a genetic profile done, then... You know, why can't that be used by the life insurance industry? Why shouldn't it be used by the life insurance industry? Because it provides so much more information. There's other information that's out there at the same time. Mm-hmm. And does that do away with underwriting at a group level, or do we now have personalised underwriting? I'd be interested in your views about that.
Yeah, great idea, great question. I think that the future of underwriting, if I was an underwriter, that's one job in our industry that I personally would be feeling worried about. I think it's all going to transition to a lot more data-driven approaches and away from much less of the human element within it. And it's the whole data scientist kind of thing. And you're often getting better results. Things. If you can get 90% prediction on elections from music preferences, come on. So... I think what you're saying there is very, very true. I think and the data universe is just continually opening up more and more all the time, and people are hunting this stuff down, making the links and the connections. Will I get into the genetics? I don't know. There's a lot of sort of sensitive political sort of stuff around that one. I wouldn't like to venture on that. But certainly... alternative predictors around that stuff. Who knows what could happen? But yeah, it's definitely the way.
Microphone's free. Who's next? Don't be shy.
I'd like to hear from someone who disagrees too.
Yeah.
Hi, Kent. Damien Thornley from RGA. Look, I just wanted to thank you for a really thoughtful presentation. Very provocative, as Martin outlined it. Just some thoughts on, you're a little bit critical of retail insurers, but I'd just surveying around the market, I'd probably think that some retail insurers are starting to make a splash in that market space. You know, things like AIA's Vitality Program, mm-hmm. and, you know, MLC Best Doctors. So mm-hmm. it sounds to me as though your point is that retail insurers haven't gone far enough. Just maybe a question on that. Mm-hmm. I think second point is... you seem to be suggesting a fundamental change in the whole business model of the life insurer from being a traditional risk-pooling vehicle towards being a business that has an interest in wellness and keeping people healthy. And I wonder if, in your view, say in 20 years' time, life insurance is ultimately just a subsection of the health insurance business, health insurance industry more broadly.
Mm. Very interesting. Thanks. On the retail side, look, let me say, the Vitality Program comes out of South Africa from the Discovery guys. I'm a huge fan. I think they've done some amazing, amazing stuff. They've got a great heritage there. Any AIA people in the room? Yeah, don't admit that. My view is that the program, as successful and wonderful as it has been, it needs revamp. It needs... needs to be more modernised. So things that I see with that program are things like it doesn't leverage the social engagement principles enough. It's a discount program rather than a rewards program, so it's lacking a lot of that utility. It lacks the gamification kind of concepts. But I am very respectful of what Discovery achieved with it. So yes, I think there is a lot more. Sorry, Damien. I think there's a lot more to be done in retail. And, you know, it's going to help us with the group too. At the moment, we don't even know who it is that we're actually insuring. We have all the data issues that we've had in group. I spoke to a number of large funds, and they were after this. They're a very paternalistic kind of thing, and if it's good for the members, they'd certainly be interested, as long as they don't have to pay, typically, through the nose for it. But the benefits of that. So there's a one way, potentially, if you look through it a bit further, of cementing a bit more longevity to the relationship with an insurer, if you can lock them in this way. Second question was...
life insurance and health insurance.
Yeah, I don't have a strong view on that one. I think the key thing in my mind is just around how the business is going to change in the way that we... it needs to become a lot more consumer-focused and relevant in that sense, the data-driven aspects of it. That's the thing that I have in the back of my mind. And there's all these unforeseen things that we haven't seen yet around that data and what's happening and what's driving businesses and the disruption that's going to come out of that. That's, I think, more what's governing my thinking in that space.
Who's next? Microphone's free.
So, Eddie, if you
don't want to hear from people who've already asked the question, here's your chance.
Yeah, I'm going to kick off. One of my issues of well-being programs is that the number of programs out there. If I look currently, my health fund's throwing me a well-being program. My employer's throwing one at me. The insurer's starting to throw one at me. It's like, is there really a huge brand, or I don't know if it's called brand value or a value creation for an insurer to spend a lot of money in a well-being program when there are so many competing things out there? And for an individual, it's which way do you go?
Great question. Yeah, I agree with you. And the reason that I went into Leap for Life and was just so excited about Leap for Life is that it's trying to create this whole platform product. It's Wellbook instead of Facebook. You know, that's the idea behind it. You need some kind of overall virtual aggregator around this that other companies can then build on. It's that open concept in the information age that we're in. But even though there's all this noise out there, none of them are really getting any traction because they're missing the fundamental problem to solve around engagement. So should an insurer jump in? I think insurers have a very compelling business case to jump on board with this thing. I don't think it's something that necessarily means they have to carry the can forever, though. If you build this the right way and you step back, the rewards concept that I spoke about, the million-dollar question is how do you fund that? That's the key. And most people would go and look at the risk managers, the governments and the insurers and the employers around that. But that's missing 95% of the funding pool, and that's all the brands. What brand doesn't want to be associated itself with a healthy, active lifestyle? So what I could have is I could have Nike coming in and saying, Kent, you need to go and run 10Ks. It's on the Leap for Life platform, and do that, and we'll give you 500 points. And I go and do it, and they give my points. Great. Why would they do that? Because they get as a condition of giving me that points earning opportunity, they give me, I have to agree to accept some kind of offer for them. Now, it could be go and buy this latest set of runners in the next 14 days that you get 20% off. It could be like their Facebook page, whatever their marketing objective is. But it creates this win-win-win scenario around it. So I think, yes, it's a crowded market, but there are ways to make the business case a lot more viable that you're not picking up the tab forever, and to generate enough rewards in the system that it's really going to move the dial for the average consumer.
Dave Miller, I put it to you, Kent, that most of the insurers out there aren't altruistic, and I think we can probably agree on that one. So I think... you know, with the collection of all the data that you're talking about and the Fitbits and whatnot, you know, some people are going to do well and be motivated by those kind of things, and the insurers will benefit from having some healthier people on their books and people getting healthier and maintaining their health over time. Do you think this will lead to a whole bunch of people not being able to get insurance, that will need insurance?
Because they're not... haven't got the right activity levels.
Absolutely.
So yeah. We exclude them. Yeah, very, very interesting question, isn't it? And that's pointing, coming back to that point I made early on too, around, you know, 40% of the population's obese. What is it going to mean for the insurance offers that you can make? I think that's a great observation. I don't really have much to add to that. I think it's a very significant part of the problem.
Can I ask a follow-on question? So a follow-on question from David and Eddie then, you know, what's in it for the life insurer, given we accept they're not altruistic. So what would we say your measures of success for implementation of a wellness program for an insurer?
I'm going to go back.
No, I can't. It's this stuff. You know, so if we're thinking about the whole value chain and the ways that you can influence the value in your business through wellbeing, you can. There's all kinds of product development ideas, new rating variables coming out of that data. I've spoken about the customer value proposition, business mix. So one of the things, you know, we talked about where someone asked the question around what's it going to impact, and I said, well, health first, morbidity last, mortality next. But the mortality isn't just one thing. It's actually made of segments. So one of the things that you can get a more immediate impact on your mortality is that you just start changing the business mix of your writing. All of a sudden, insurance has become relevant and meaningful to healthy people. You can start attracting that kind of clientele, and that's going to have an immediate impact. You can start perpetuating the selection effect. Everyone keeps on running down the street to the next insurer all their healthy lives. But if I've got something here that is meaningful and valuable to my life today outside of that very intangible insurance promise, then, hey, I'm going to hang around. I get to hold on to it. Retention issues. So that's what I'm saying. It goes right along the curve, all of that sort of stuff.
We'll take one more.
Adrian Fortescue here. Given that we've seen obesity increasing and we also know at the same time mortality's actually been continues to get a bit better, it's probably slowed a little bit, but it's... Do you think society really cares about being well?
That's coming back to that myth one. It's a great question. That's coming back to that myth one. People will act rationally. No, they don't. And they just think, oh, there'll be a new drug, a new procedure or something. It'll save me in the end. But business and governments, we sure should be caring because it's got huge impacts. So that's coming back to the issue is engagement. You've got to really bring people on this journey, and just the whole wellness education awareness thing, I agree, not going to work. Not going to work at all.
So thank you very much for your comments and questions. I've been asked to give you a reminder about feedback on the session, but I'll throw to Kent for the final word.
So apart from, let's try not to get the session straight after lunch next time we do something like this. The three takeaways that I'd like to leave with you are, today's life insurance business model is outdated. There's aspects of what we do that belongs in the old world, and we need to change. Second thing is that the information age is most definitely upon us, and it's the data companies. They might have some completely different proposition that the consumer sees, but underneath they are data companies. They're the ones that are going to win. They're the ones that are going to dominate and disrupt. And the third thing is that wellness is not a product feature. It's a business strategy. It impacts every part of the value chain. You need to invest in that, therefore, rather than just tinker around the edges if you really want to make a difference. And it's writing that data away to create context and relevance of your offer to everyday consumers. It's bridging all these contradictions we're seeing in the world we're living in, and it's the way to build in resilience and sustainability of our profit streams.
Please join me in thanking Ken Hopper.